Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. Hello. I hope that your day has been amazing. I know that I'm coming in super inspired after our lunch and just a great morning. So I hope that you all are feeling energized and excited for a Friday afternoon. But before we get started, just as anything, just some housekeeping, making sure that your cell phones are either silenced or turned off, just to make sure that we don't disrupt our amazing speakers. And we will get started with our conversation today. So my name is Maria Medrano. I am with Cisco Systems. I am part of the Office of Inclusion and Collaboration, which is our diversity office at Cisco. And as we have been for the last few years, we're super excited to be a sponsor of Conferences for Women. We are hosting over 160 of our high potential women today. And you got an opportunity to hear from Karen Walker, who is our CMO, and a few of our other leaders earlier this morning. It's really important for us at Cisco to ensure that diversity is at the forefront of all the work that we do. And when we think about what diversity means to us, we really, really anchor it on full spectrum diversity. So we think about it from all angles and ensure that every person that walks into our door feels that they're being seen, valued, respected, and heard. And so for that reason, we continue to partner with Conferences for Women, continue to develop in our talent, and are really excited to host all of our talent today. Now, today we're in for an amazing treat. I actually had the opportunity to connect with a few of our women. And the topic here is pioneering equity and diversity in your organization. Now, I ran into our thought leader here, Tiffany Jana, and I said, tell me a little bit about yourself. Why are we here to listen to you? And let me tell you, in the first few minutes, she had me at hello. First of all, she is a founder, she is a CEO, and she's a thought leader in the diversity and inclusion space, and she's leading amazing solutions around diversity and inclusion. The reason why that's important is that she's leading it from a business perspective, understanding that technology is pivotal to ensuring that we give an opportunity to amplify the impact that traditional solutions have had, but most importantly, solutions that we're thinking about that are more forward-thinking can have for future generations. Now, you're going to have an opportunity to hear from her and a few of our panelists. But before we do that, some fun facts. I said, tell me something that they don't know about you, because obviously you can all read and you can see what's in here from her bio. A couple of things that I learned from her. She had beautiful dreadlocks for about 26 years. Those were who she was from a brand perspective. I mean, you saw those dreadlocks, you knew that it was her. And she decided to chop them and shave her hair. And again, after her third and final proven marriage, she decided to not only shave her hair, but also to color it with beautiful colors. And the beautiful color you're going to see today is the color blue, because blue to her represents life. And so with that, I would love to introduce Tiffany Jana.
Way up on stage. I just jumped on up here. Well, thank you guys so much for joining me today. This is such an important conversation, and it is an honor to be here with you. I've got two books in the bookstore. I think that's part of the reason why I was invited here. Overcoming Bias was my first book. Erasing Institutional Bias is my second book. And the conversation around diversity and inclusion has been evolving over time, and this is a very good thing that that's been happening. And the conversation around biases in the workplace and what do we do about them is something that now has traction in the world and in the workplace more than it ever has. A lot of us have been trying to make the case for diversity, equity, and inclusion, or diversity and inclusion. Equity is a new part of the conversation. And it's always been a part, it's been a social justice case for a very long time. We were doing it because it was the right thing to do. It has evolved from just having a bunch of people who are different, if you're lucky enough to actually have that in the workplace, because we still find that many of our organizations have incredible homogeneity because we tend to replicate ourselves and tap our own networks. But we're now looking at inclusion and really creating space for people to show up how they are, perhaps with their blue hair, their dreadlocks, their afros, whatever it is that they want to express. I myself happen to identify as four different marginalized identities. I'm gender nonconforming. I have an invisible disability. I suffer with depression and anxiety. We want people to be able to show up and really be who they are. And equity is about creating that experience where everybody can be successful regardless of the demographic that they represent. And so pioneering diversity and inclusion in your workplace is something that we can look at now, not just from the perspective of the CEO, the board of directors, the leadership who have their hands on the accesses of lever, the levers of access, right? Who they can actually change things because they run things, they have the power. So in my second book, Erasing Institutional Bias, the purpose for writing that was because each of us actually does have not only the ability, but I argue the responsibility to own the space that you occupy, understand the privilege and access that you have. It might be small, it might be big, but we have the opportunity to lead where we stand and to actually make change, instigate change, and lead from the perspective of diversity, equity, and inclusion. So there are things that we can do to ensure that we're more successful. My first book was Overcoming Bias, and that was really leaning towards the work that we have to do as individuals in order to lead these conversations. Because if you show up in your organization and you just say, hey, I see that we've got a bias problem, a diversity problem, it's your problem, you need to fix it, you're not offering a solution. You're naming a problem and you're creating a problem for yourself, because if you're all alone standing up there doing it, it's very easy to silence you. It's very easy to dismiss the opinion or the experience of one person. So the first thing we have to do is really do our own deep personal work and understand what it is that we're bringing to the table, what are the challenges that we have, and how might we be benefiting from or contributing to the biases as they exist in the organization. Because believe it or not, regardless of what identity you represent, whether you're a marginalized identity, a minority demographic, or a majority demographic, you might be benefiting from or contributing to the very systems that you want to change. So understanding your role in those things is the first important thing. The next thing you want to do is to try to get some, like, lead with data. The reason that I'm trying to pioneer this space where we can actually quantify diversity ROI, because most of the diversity work that's been happening for the past couple of decades has been, we're going to sprinkle some diversity training on you and hope that everything works out great, right? You don't have bias anymore. You're great. So the analogy I like to use with diversity and inclusion work is, you know, it's not like an appendectomy, right? You cut that thing out and you're done. It's more like hygiene, right? You know, you got to brush your teeth and you got to wash them stinky pits every day or else it comes back to haunt you. So sometimes you got to be like, oh, sweetie, you got a little sexism right there between your teeth. I'm going to need you to get that out, right? So if we think about it as ongoing work that has to happen, that's the approach we should take. And so with using technology and using data, if you lead with data, you'll get a lot further. I was saying to our MC earlier that, you know, if you're just starting from a place that is nebulous, and you're just starting with social justice, you're going to have to appeal only to the hearts of people and maybe to their minds if you can make that leap. The reason I love this work is that I come from a legacy of diversity and inclusion, and I'm a business person. I'm a CEO. My degrees are in business. And so what you can do with technology and data is you can take that information and you can present it as, here are the facts. These are the numbers. These are the things we're trying to influence. These are the things we're trying to change. So the conversation that we're going to have now with our amazing panel is going to be about all the different things that you can do to really get some traction with your diversity, equity, and inclusion. So I'd like to invite my panelists up here on the stage to join me. Give them a round of applause and we'll do some introductions. All right. So we've got right here to my left, Lauren Aguilar. She is one of the world's foremost scientific experts on diversity and inclusion. She was also named top 40 under 40 by San Francisco Business Times and is a top diversity influencer. We've got, yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think you can read all of the other amazing things, but we don't want to waste our precious time on things that you can read. We want to get to the thoughts. All right, Lily Zhang is an organizational consultant, executive coach, and diversity and inclusion expert who works with organizations to turn positive intentions into positive impact. A dedicated changemaker and advocate, she has co-authored multiple books and has had her work published in the New York Times, Quartz, At Work, Entrepreneur, and HR Executive. And last but not least, we've got Susan Schmidt, who leads Human Resources for Applied Materials, and it's more than 20,000 global employees. Under her previous HR leadership at Rockwell, Their inclusive practices were awarded the prestigious and rigorous Catalyst Award in 2017, and they earned a perfect score of 100 on the Human Rights Campaign's Foundation's annual Corporate Equality Index for LGBT equality and the distinction of best places to work for LGBT equality. Woo. So when Watermark Conferences for Women tells you they bring out the heavy hitters, they're not kidding, okay? All right, so I'd like to start with Susan. From your 30 years of corporate HR and management consulting experience, what doesn't work and what does work in creating more inclusive and diverse workforces?
Excellent. Do you have a half an hour? Yeah, so the benefit of working for so many years, 30 plus years in corporations, great companies, cross industry, is as an HR professional, I feel like I've had the opportunity to do everything wrong. And I would say it's a lot of the work that we try to do, HR professionals are always well-intentioned trying to solve these kinds of issues. But the kinds of things that I noticed that were not working, and I actually think they were making things worse in some cases, with again, nothing but the best of intentions. I felt like the leaders in the organization looked to me to solve the problems. I had a leader once back at my Kellogg days who said, "Susan, just tell us what to bake for the bake sale and we'll do it." So there was a desire to do something differently, but it was my job to figure out what it was. Mm-hmm. I spent hours and hours and hours with my team doing analysis, trying to figure out from a data standpoint what was happening in the talent metrics, and was there an explanation for why we weren't seeing women and underrepresented minorities go higher up in the organization. And despite all the analysis, nothing was changing. We did stay interviews with key talent, trying to figure out what wasn't working. We did what I would describe as traditional training programs. At that time, I was working as a head of HR for a $4 billion business. It was me and 9 men from all over the world. And they were always very polite and respectful. But when I stood up to talk about diversity, they would wait quietly, and some of their eyes would roll to the back of their heads, hoping I would stop talking so they could get back to the business. Yeah. This same group went to a training program. Again, the company was trying to do the right things. But in the training program, one of the men was counting down how many hours till he could drink his Chardonnay. Two of the guys were playing tic-tac-toe, and three of them were heckling the facilitator. And, you know, again, it was embarrassing, and it was frustrating. And I felt that the more we talked about diversity and the more we talked about these different things and did these different programs, I felt like it was creating more of a divide in the organization, that all the groups that we speak about, women, et cetera, LGBT, all the different groups that we categorize as diversity, were trying very hard to be heard and to identify what wasn't working. And then the men were sort of over on the side, removed from the discussion, not really viewing it as their opportunity or issue or anything. And so there was this big divide, and underneath of it was this implied judgment that somehow the men had done something wrong, and that if they would just stop doing it, everything would be great, just like you said, the appendectomy. I love that. Wow. And I got really frustrated. I really got tired of trying all these things and pushing the things up the hill, and it wasn't working. Yeah. And so I don't know if you asked about what does work. Maybe that's another question, but to me, that's more important. I think that I just got tired of feeling like it was making things worse. Mm-hmm. So when I went to Rockwell 11 plus years ago, I decided to do nothing that I'd ever done. And I was very lucky. I had a couple of early experiences at this company, great company, engineering technology company, Fortune 500. I noticed in my first management meeting that it was me and all men. You know, there were maybe 15 people in the room for the entire day. A couple women came and went, and the chief technology officer was Indian. And for some reason that specific day, all the men were wearing blue shirts. And I don't know why, but that just struck me as really odd. I thought maybe I was in the Twilight Zone. The next experience I had within the first month of my employment was I went to our North American sales engineering meeting, the leadership team. 120 people in the room, Dallas, Texas. In the room, there were 3 women. 2 of us were HR, so, quote, we don't count. And although we do count, all the HR people know we count. And there was 1 Indian man, and that was it. And I was really concerned. And I came back and I worked with a colleague of mine who worked for me, an African-American, extremely talented vice president on my team, and said, we have a serious talent problem. And so the first thing we did, and you talked about it, using data, we pulled together a key, very diverse group of people with 6 executives from the CEO staff, And we told the talent story, the internal story and the external story of what was happening with the talent that we were trying to recruit. Just a quick snippet is that in 2006, of all the women that left that business in the U.S. voluntarily, 60% said it could have been prevented. 60. And so in the statistics, the data was unbelievable. So that was the first thing we did, was to tell that story and talk about it as a talent story, because talent comes in lots of packages. And if you're only attracting a certain slice of that talent, you are missing out in terms of the company's potential. And I was so passionate about it that this was really the beginning of starting this different path. The second thing we did is we brought in an outside partner, and I'll tell you more about that later because I don't want to dominate this discussion. But we put people through an experiential process. And in that process, one of the key insights that was taught was that when we talk about diversity and inclusion, we talk about all these groups. But we never talk about men as a group. Mm-hmm. And there's a really good reason for that. Men don't associate with being in a group. They associate with being an individual. And that they've gone through their own careers and lives dealing with their own challenges and obstacles, and that they've reached whatever level of success they've reached because of themselves, because of how hard they worked, because of their persistence and commitment and dedication. And what we learn in this workshop is that actually men are a member of a group. They don't realize it, and you referenced it. It's the dominant group. Right. Every culture around the world has a dominant group. Every organization has a dominant group. And in many cases, it's men. In many cases in the United States, it's white men. And that wasn't something to be concerned about because, you know, dominant group, non-dominant groups exist everywhere. And it's important to understand that if you're a member of the dominant group, you automatically have access to power and privilege that those not in the group don't automatically get, just as a result of your birthright. And so the privilege isn't to be judged or looked at negatively. It's to be used honorably. And that the only way you can understand and start eliminating systemic barriers is through partnership in the organization. That it's not one person's job to fix it. It's not the employee resource groups to fix it. It takes that work in partnership with dominant group leaders to really understand and drive out systemic barriers. So I'll stop there. I can go on and on, but that was a significant shift in the work we did.
But such an important conversation. When people think about diversity, they often think about, they just focus on difference, and then they focus on the minorities, however that shows up. And what I like about that approach and the approach that I take at my consultancy is I take an aspirational approach, so 100% aspirational, not deficit-focused, not focused on what you're doing wrong, not focused on what's broken, but focused on how diversity, equity, and inclusion is an asset, how it will benefit and serve your organization, and creating room for everyone to be a meaningful part of the conversation and know what you know how they're contributing, including the majority demographics. A diversity conversation is not a diversity conversation if you're leaving anyone out, and that includes white men.
And the problem is that when we don't talk about this, those of us that are in the non-dominant groups feel that there's this subtle expectation that to be successful, we have to assimilate into the dominant group.
That's right.
And I can tell a lot of different stories about things I tried to do to be one of the guys and what a waste of discretionary effort and time that is.
So that leads really nicely into my question. My question for Lily, which is about allyship, right? So if we're going to be if we're going to work in service of the other, sometimes it's not even about our group. Sometimes we're given opportunities to advocate for change on issues that don't affect us personally. So what would you say is the role of allyship in this work?
Absolutely. So first, I want to respond to the very last thing you said, which is that I wrote a book about how it doesn't work to be one of the guys. So
it does not.
It doesn't work. No.
I'll never be a guy.
And well, you could always transition in the workplace, and then you would be a guy. And I also wrote a book about that. But it doesn't usually work. I'll tell you that.
That's fair.
So on allyship, I think in my work as a consultant, I work mainly with teams. I work mainly with teams and HR inside organizations. And people always come to me asking the question of, okay, I get it. I've learned that oppression is real, racism is real, sexism is real. Can you give me the list of 10 things that I should never, ever say again? So I can never, ever say these 10 things again and get my little box checked and go back to work now, maybe? And that's often the way in which we've approached these conversations about allyship is as a form of bystander intervention. Who here has heard of bystander intervention? Yeah, a few folks? Yeah, lots of folks. So here's the thing. It's not like bystander intervention is unimportant, but oftentimes these conversations about allyship are boiled down into these very, very basic, well, for race, you don't say these words with this group of people, and then for this group of people, you don't say those words. For gender, you don't say these words. For class, you don't say these words. And so you see people like furiously scribbling down on a list, you know, on a sheet of paper after going through the PowerPoint presentation, all the things that you can't say, and they feel very proud of this. They feel very good about this. And it's the wrong approach. I'm just going to go out and say it. It's the wrong approach. Allyship is not about stamping out the negative behaviors, right? Mm-hmm. Though that's important as well. Allyship is about creating helpful, inclusive, healthy structures and systems within organizations and teams. It's about building rather than tearing down. And this really connects to a lot of what folks are going to be talking about today and what you've already mentioned. But I think when you give people a stake in building something bigger, rather than telling people that they have something in their head that they need to excise or get out or remove, you suddenly see buy-in, right? When you go to teams and you say, we are going to build, for example, we're going to have a meeting, we're going to create a set of meeting norms where everyone feels great, and you, the manager or the team leader, are going to help us create the best meeting norms in this entire company. In fact, we're going to run meetings so well that all the other teams are going to beg you to figure out how the hell you run such good, inclusive meetings. That's much, much better of a sell than saying your meetings are biased as hell and you need to like work on making your meetings less shitty. Right? No one wants to do that. Like, I've never talked to a manager that, you know, is self-flagellating enough to be like, oh no, everything I do is awful. Please tell me how awful I am so I can be less awful, right? And it never works. Everyone wants to feel good about themselves, and that's something that you can actually count on. That's something that you can take advantage of. Everyone wants to feel like a good person. So you give them ways to feel like a good person. You give them things that they can create. So where does this relate to allyship? Well, when I go to talk to my clients, usually my clients are managers, and they all ask me for things that they can do. But it's their team members that are usually feeling perhaps the most powerless. It's their team members that are saying, I'm an IC, I'm, you know, an entry-level employee, I can't do anything, my manager is not doing his job because our meetings suck. And I just want my manager to run better meetings so I can do my work. And so it creates this position where managers are given all the responsibility to create all of the diversity and inclusion in the workplace. The ICs are feeling powerless. Everyone loses, right? And so what I usually bring to these conversations, if I get to talk to the ICs, is I reframe the role of allyship in DEI spaces. I talk about allyship is about building. And here's the thing. Everyone can build things. Everyone has some influence and power in the workplace. Even if it's what things you put on your desk, everyone has power. Everyone has some ability to influence people, groups, institutions even. If you're friends with the manager, that actually gives you power, right? Your coworkers who aren't friends with the manager can't say the same things that you can as someone who's friends with the manager. And so what allyship can be is for each of us to really look deep into ourselves and to reflect on, yes, what are the things that I believe? Who am I? But also, what do I have access to that nobody else in the organization has access to? What makes me special, not just in terms of who I am, but where I am, what I know, how I know it, why I know it, who I know? How close am I to the centers of power in the organization? Every organization has formal and informal centers of power, right? You can look at your org chart, you can see who's the supervisor of who, but there are invisible networks of power as well, right? There are some people who the manager really likes to talk to, right? And there are some people that the manager doesn't really like to talk to as much, and these are very real dynamics. And so you need to understand as an ally that in some ways, like, you are the strategic consultant, right? I'm not here to tell you like things you know about the organization. In fact, I'm here to find out what you know about the organization so I can tell the manager what you know about the organization. If anything, you should be doing my job for me, right? If anything, it's the ICs that know all of the inner workings of the organization. It's just a matter of connecting the right people. And so I think allyship is a matter of strategy. It's a matter of knowing where you can make the biggest impact. It's a matter of knowing where you can hit hardest with the least amount of effort. And this is where I see a lot of people stumbling, because here's the thing, DEI work is grueling. Yes. It sucks. It just sucks, right? And so I see people like, you know, listing out like, here's all the DEI things that I need to do, and I'm just gonna tackle them one at a time, not realizing that like maybe like number 8 on the list, like I can do better than anyone else in this room, right? Number 1 on this list, I just suck at. But because number 1 is first, I'm just gonna start doing number 1 on this list and get myself burnt out in 3 weeks because like, I don't know, I suck at writing reports and number 1 just happened to be write a report about DEI. And so again, allyship is not about doing all the things. It's about doing the right thing that only you can do and doing it really damn well. And learning about all of the other people in the space and learning about what skills they have as well. Because maybe your coworker down the cubicle is really good at number 8 and you couldn't do number 8 to save your life. So like maybe you should partner up and talk about like what it is to create a movement together, to create an initiative together and expand this outwards. What is your HR really good at? What's your manager really good at? How can you all work together to use your unique skills and talents to create change within a workplace?
So I want to jump off what you just said about leaning into what you do really well. And this is going to segue to you because this particular person right here, right, Lauren has a base of experience that includes research. So she's got a research-driven career. Like she's been published in, her research has been published in Journal of Experimental Psychology, Physics Today. She's a thought leader, Fast Company, Women in Science Forum. Your research-based approach, based on everything that you've learned and your depth of experience, what do you think is the future of diversity and inclusion for organizations?
I love that question. Before I hop into it, I need to have a little inclusion moment of my own here. I'm going to stand in my truth on shaky legs for a moment.
Go ahead.
So I am early in my pregnancy, and I have terrible morning sickness right now. So if you see me run off the stage, just don't be alarmed. I'm okay. I'm going to have a saltine, and I'll come back. Just don't want anyone to freak out if you see me running up.
Everybody who can relate, who's ever been through that before, that's
Thank
right.
You.
That's
Thank
right.
You.
Yes.
Appreciate it. Appreciate the support. Okay, back to business. So I've been doing research in this space as a social psychologist for the past 20 years, and then my career has really been a transition to translating the methods and the insights from science to diversity, inclusion, belonging work for organizations. And what I've seen over this span of time is really big change. I mean, I think we've made so many strides. You know, we started, even I would say from like civil rights movement to the early 2000s, it was about brave conversations, it was about regulation, it was about social justice, and it was about things like support and development of our underserved or underrepresented groups. And I mean, as we saw, that has only moved the needle so far. And there was a really big focus on women and gender, but not as much focus on people of color and other groups that are marginalized in the workplace often. So then, you know, the pendulum sort of swung the other way. So I'd say early 2000s, I think it was like 2011, 2013, Google, Facebook, other tech giants released their numbers. And I really commend them for doing that because it set off this new wave that was super data driven. And I was, as a scientist, I was really excited about that. At the time, I was at the Clayman Institute for Gender Research, and there was no career path for someone like me who was into the science of diversity and inclusion and wanted to use that to make a difference. So that was the first time I said, oh, maybe people are listening. Maybe people are listening to the data now. And that was really exciting. But when that happened, and I would say in some of my early consulting years, I saw us focus on things like unconscious bias, unconscious bias trainings, and solely the data. We forgot about the heart. So when I think about the future of diversity and inclusion, I think about three things: the head, the heart, and the hands. And the head being the data. You know, anytime I work with a client, I'm saying, show me your data. So let's not throw spaghetti at the wall for an entire new inclusive hiring process. Let's see where there are particular places that you can shore up a process. Like, for instance, we look at often like pass-through rates. Like, how do people of different identity groups pass through from resume review to a phone screen, then to an on-site interview? And so every company I do that data analysis with, we see a different place where they are losing out on diversity and where there may be unconscious bias in a system. For some companies, it's the resume review. For another company, it's that phone screen or the in-person interview. So using the data, we can really pinpoint, and in a resource-effective way, pinpoint where to change a process. So you look at the data and then understand the processes, the policies, the protocols being used. So for instance, if we see like, okay, it's that on-site interview, then what's the process? So I'm gonna say like, show me your interview protocols. Oh, you don't have one. Oh, okay. How do you interview for core values? How do you interview for a values fit or values alignment or value add? Oh, I often hear, well, it's just, you know, do I want to get a beer with this person? Oof. Or, you know, do I feel like I could get stuck in an airport with this person on a long layover? Yeah, that's who I'm going to hire. Because, you know, we have this sense of, like, we want to hire people who we like, who we can get along with, but then we end up hiring mini-me's, people who are just like us.
No surprise.
So the data, the head part, is really important. That can really help us hone in on small tweaks that we can make to people processes. But then the other side, and where I think we've sort of lost things in this like obsession with the data, which, by the way, I love this obsession, but we've lost the heart. Mm-hmm. And so where I think that what we're going to do is really have this trifecta of head, heart, and the hand. So the heart is storytelling, understanding the qualitative data with things like focus groups, interviews, having experiential learning moments where people are getting to know each other as true humans, showing up as authentic selves. I think the heart side is also about focusing on a belonging. We've talked a lot about diversity and inclusion, and now we're starting to talk about equity. But belonging, I really see that as a key factor in the future of diversity and inclusion. And what I mean by belonging is an individual sense of whether the workplace culture is a good match for them. Whether you as an individual feel like you can show up as your true self, you feel valued and respected for who you are, that you have voice, and that you can fully contribute and thrive. And I think belonging is the future because data shows belonging, an individual employee's sense of belonging, is the highest predictor of engagement and retention. It's also a huge predictor of health. It affects the number of sick days people take. So we were talking about ROI earlier. A focus on belonging is going to give us a huge ROI in the future. The other side that I think is a really important next step is head, the heart, the hands. The hands are tools. So I was talking about small tweaks you can make. I like to call this, I'm going to quote Shelley Carrell from Stanford University, sociologist. She likes to work with this framework called small wins. So once again, not throwing spaghetti at the wall to process, but working with data scientists to understand where there are particular places that you can tweak a process using both scientific or evidence-based tools and strategies and understanding the people behind those strategies. So I think it's really about, you know, I've been to many unconscious bias trainings where it's like, you have unconscious bias, okay, great. Have fun with that, bye.
Bye-bye.
But we can't disrupt automatic neurological brain processes. We need to add in structures to all of our people processes that disrupt these automatic brain processes. So I think it's going to be that trifecta of like the head, the heart, and the hands, and a focus on belonging and these small wins. It's really going to make the difference.
Yeah. So you know, when I'm asked like, what is the one thing? What's the one thing that people need to know? If I had to distill all of the work that I've done around the world with all different kinds of populations, because like you said, Susan, every culture has a dominant population, mm-hmm. and people like to say, you know, I go overseas and they're like, oh, you're from America, you guys have that racism thing because you had that slavery thing, so mm-hmm. it's different here, we don't have that. Mm-hmm. Show me where your minority population is.
Yeah.
Show me who do you not like? Because mm-hmm. someone's always being Definitely. Marginalized in every mm-hmm. culture. It's a human thing, right? Mm-hmm. So if I had to distill all the work that I do down to one core, like, facet, one principle, it is that particularly institutionally, organizationally, we have lost our sense of common humanity. Mm. When we have incredible grace and patience and time for the stories and the pain and the foibles of our friends, of our family. We're invested in those relationships. But when we get to the workplace, suddenly, you know, people are cogs in a machine. I don't care how you're feeling. I don't care how you're doing. We have to restore that humanity, and that contributes to that sense of belonging. If we remember that we all have a story, every single one of us is right now fighting our own individual war. Some of us are winning them. Some of us are not. But when you understand that your fellow person is a person and you leave room for that, then suddenly empathy, compassion, things like that start to play in. So if each of you, and I'll start back with you, Susan, if you had like just one thing that you wanted to leave folks with today, what would that be?
Well, when I think about one thing, there are many things, but one thing for sure, I do agree with your earlier point that every single one of us has an opportunity to be influential leaders in our companies, no matter where you sit. Mm-hmm. And so my personal view is that there's a great opportunity to partner with the men in the dominant group. And so there are some wonderful resources out there available for you. I would point you to a couple. One is called MARC, M-A-R-C. It stands for Men Advocating Real Change. It's a part of the work that Catalyst does. They've got wonderful tools and resources. And you're going to see, I think, future of diversity and inclusion is you're going to see a growing trend where men are going to become much more involved in understanding that this is work we do together. Mm-hmm. Mark's one. You can take a look at Catalyst's website's outstanding. The outside partner that we've used to help you understand how to bring this partnership together with our male colleagues is called White Men as Full Diversity Partners. It's a wonderful organization that's doing very powerful work in this arena. And I think the other thing I would add here is you're thinking about how do I influence in my organization is becoming knowledgeable about some of these resources that I don't think we've done enough of leveraging. And then look within your company for a leader that you respect, a male leader that you think is open-minded, who'd be willing to learn about an opportunity to truly leave a legacy in the company. And I was very fortunate that I had only one executive who wanted to go look at his data. And he became enlightened as he went through this work with Bill Proudman's organization, and it changed the whole company. And the results were unbelievable. And so it's that partnering up with someone in your organization. And then the other piece of it, again, trying to create that inclusion within your organization, find an HR leader you greatly respect and turn that person onto some of these resources, because they can be a huge lever in your partnership to try to shift things in the organization.
Awesome. I've actually seen that people get very bent out of shape about the detractor, the person who's just complaining about all the diversity things. I hate this. I don't like it. It's terrible. That's actually my favorite person when I go into to help people mm-hmm. with an initiative, because it means they're still engaged. Yes. They're somehow heavily engaged. They're mad because it's not going the way they'd like to see it. So when you lead with that data, when you build the coalition, when you tap into the heart and the stories, and you show someone the quantitative data, the qualitative data, when they see that story unfold, they, to a person, always become my biggest champions in the work.
Can I tell one quick story? Yeah. So when I started this work in this last company, one senior executive, a white male, came to me, and he said, best of intentions, do you really want to be the new white woman in HR with a diversity agenda? And it was sort of like, you know, it was like, what are you doing? You're going to rock the boat. Nobody really cares about this. It's going to ruin your reputation. Your credibility uh-huh. is going to be gone. And he became my biggest champion.
See? Yeah.
Because he was the one who got challenged about, you know, oh, we don't have an old boy network in our company. And one brave woman in this workshop stood up and said, if you have to say that, I guarantee you're a member of that club. And he went back to his credit, and he started looking at his own data. And he'd been talking about more women in that sales engineering organization for 10 years, and the representation had declined substantially.
Wow.
And so he put his entire leadership team through this 3.5-day workshop. I didn't have a budget. He paid for everything. And then they started the focus groups and the culture work. Mm-hmm. And that began the journey for the whole company that pulled every other executive along.
That's awesome.
Because
wow.
The one thing about our white male colleagues that I absolutely love is they're competitive. And if one's having progress...
Use what you can, sister.
You know, it's true. You just need one who's yeah. willing to partner to become educated about the partnership, the
That's
allyship
great.
That you talked
awesome.
About.
Awesome. All right, Lily?
Yeah, so I think... The biggest thing that I'd like y'all to take away is communication is so much of this work. I think what I've found is that the data is powerful, the stories are powerful, but people in positions of power respond really, really well when you can frame the things that you want in terms of the things that they want, mm-hmm. when you can give quote unquote the business case for diversity, but also many other cases for diversity as well. I remember a client that We were making a product, and diversity was a distraction for them. They were just like, we don't want to talk about workplaces. We're busy trying to like hit our client in this country. And you know, one of the conversations we had was, do you understand your client in that country? And they were like, what do you mean? And we're like, do you understand your client? It's not America, right? You're not working with white people. Do you know what not white people act like? He had never been asked that question in his life. And he was like, well, we made the best product for us and then gave it to them. And then I was like, do they like it? And he was like... And then he checked the data and they didn't really like it. So here's the thing, right? I think every single story that you can come up with is more powerful when you can connect the diversity that you want to see mm-hmm. with the real business outcomes that they want to see too. Because here's the thing, like diversity is not an addendum mm-hmm. to all of the other things. Like
exactly.
diversity is the reality of our world. And if you can't deal with reality, your business shouldn't exist anyways to begin with, right? And so all of these businesses that are making products, that are designing things, I think they are doing so somewhat successfully in large part because they are folks that are designing for the in-group. They are designing for people just like them. And maybe just a prediction, I don't think that's going to continue being profitable forever. I don't think that's going to continue being a thing forever. And so increasingly, we need to be able to tell these sorts of stories, whether they're about representation, allowing them to understand their clients' needs better, whether it's about happier employees being able to produce better work and thus, you know, lower customer complaints because the products aren't made shittily because your employees are pissed, right? So all sorts of things like that. I think there are many, many stories we can tell. And I would love if folks could take this back and realize that the diversity initiative that you tell or that you work on has many, many stories hidden within it. And here's the thing, you can tell different stories to different people. I'm gonna be honest about this. As DEI practitioners, we tell different stories to different people all the time because you need to find the most effective way to get things done. And all these stories are true, right? You can tell the moral story for DEI in the same breath that you tell the business case for DEI mm-hmm. because we contain multitudes. Mm-hmm. All of these stories are fine. You need to learn how to tell these different stories for different audiences, and you need to learn how to follow up with these stories as well so that your managers, your HR, can understand the story that works best for them so that they can take the stories to their stakeholders and to say, this is why we need DEI. Maybe that's not the story that you like best. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. The outcomes are the most important here. If we can get more people hired, if we can increase feelings of belonging, if we can create a product that isn't garbage, if we can make our customers like us, all sorts of things. As long as these things happen, right? Personally, I'm willing to tell whatever true story is necessary to get there.
Thanks for that.
True is important. True is very important.
Awesome. All right. I want you to answer that question, and then we're going to open up the floor for Q&A. So start percolating on your questions now. But what is the one thing that you would give these good people?
I'm going to have one big thing, but I'm going to encapsulate a couple little tidbits
popcorns.
In there.
Okay.
So I'll start off with the one insight. So there is a huge difference between support and belonging. When I talked about that trajectory, kind of historically how diversity and inclusion has gone, we've really focused more on support. So leadership development for women or employee resource groups. And those things are very important. And the research shows us they do a couple things. Those types of sort of, you could say, in-group or connecting people who are alike, who are also often in the marginalized group together, leads to more feelings of support, leads to feelings of camaraderie with that group, and there are role models that you can find within that group. She can do it, so I can too. And that's all really important, but what we know, where that falls short, is around belonging. So to feel belonging, you need to get out of that niche. Belonging is defined by feeling a sense of connection to the dominant culture. So it's about allyship. It's about connecting with others who are both from the majority group or the privileged group or the people in power. So there are lots of different ways that we can create both support and belonging. I'll give you two tools. So one tool, and I'm going to give a shout out to my collaborator, Andrea Robb here from Airbnb, who's been an amazing partner, really experimental, and at the core of their mission at Airbnb is belong anywhere. So they really live and believe in belonging and are also willing to look at the data and experiment together around it. So one way to create more inclusion as well as pull bias out of systems is to think about what are the simple tools that you can add into people processes that might have bias. So we work together to think about, okay, the performance management system. It's like, okay, all right, whatever we're talking about performance management, we all have to take a little breath here. So there's one place where there's a ton of bias. So when leaders all get together to calibrate, you know, everyone's done their performance reviews and we all get together to decide who's going to get that bonus, who's going to get a promotion, et cetera, you're layering bias on top of bias. So each individual has their unconscious bias based on cultural stereotypes. And then when you put people together in a room, you have things like groupthink and other group dynamics, like anchoring on the opinion of the highest status person in the room. So what's one way that you can pull bias and make this more inclusive, pull bias out and make it a more inclusive process? So we experimented. I'll just get to the, we went through many iterations, but I'll just get to the end iteration that we're working with now. So we created these things called calibration cards. They're an actual card, like you can hold in your hands, which is an interesting thing in and of itself these days at a tech company, like a printed out piece of paper that you hold in your hands, that leaders have in front of them that remind them about the different types of bias that can come out in performance reviews and give them actual phrases and tools to address bias in the moment. So you said, oh, you said he's really high potential. Can you give me one behavioral example, like one time that you saw his high potential? So it's giving people ways to call out bias in polite, often even humorous ways that feel comfortable in the group and call for evidence, what behaviors can we see that we can make decisions based on. That's one way. Another way to create more belonging as opposed to just support is thinking about, you talked a lot about inclusive team meetings and allyship in meetings. How many people have heard the term psychological safety?
Yes.
Here. Okay, awesome. So for those of you who haven't heard it, it's kind of a jargony term, but I think it's worth like calling it its real term. It means feeling as an individual that you can speak up in a group, be totally authentically who you are, that you're not going to be reprimanded or like socially like taken down in any way for having an opinion that might not be popular. It's being your full authentic self. And one simple way that you can do this, this is a tool that I use on my own teams, is like favorite mistake Fridays. Mm-hmm. Especially our leaders, we need to feel comfortable sharing mistakes. There's been some really great research that's shown that more psychological safety then leads to more information sharing and learning behaviors on teams, which is what drives more team effectiveness and, frankly, more revenue. So when we allow people to feel like they belong, to openly share mistakes, they then learn more from each other versus like hoarding information and hoarding status. When you create psychological safety, make it okay to make mistakes, be not a cog in the wheel, but an authentic human, then people will share more information. I won't make the same mistake that you did last week. You won't make the same mistake that I did last quarter, and we can move more quickly. Mm-hmm. We're a more well-oiled machine. So it's taking time to think about the human side of our teams. And that simple thing is sharing mistakes. But this has to start with leaders. Yes. And leaders often do not ever break the shell of, you know, apparent perfection and strength. So leaders have to be the first ones to say, hey, I really messed up on this thing. Here's what I did. And importantly, when you share mistakes, share the mistake and then what you learned from it. Because it can't just be like a gab sesh. You need to share what you, I've seen it go wrong, actually. So importantly, it's those two things, sharing the mistake and then sharing what you learned from it. And it's incredibly helpful. And it's such a breath of fresh air.
Awesome. We have at least one question. Yes!
Right.
All right, what is your question?
I actually have two questions. Oh, so,
bonus!
They're real quick. One is, in this time of gathering data, what kind of culture, communication, and tools will make it easier for employees to self-identify the hidden as well as the visible ways that they want to identify, so we can gather that data and, you know, move our D&I, our DIB strategy forward. The second question, I have seen examples of companies wanting to keep leaders accountable to diversity quota. However, how I've seen it demonstrated is leaders are getting bonuses based on it. So that doesn't work so great in seeing people who make a shitload of money make more money when it doesn't change anything underneath their teams. So I would love to hear some ideas from you guys on how there can be other ways of being accountable for executives as well as hiring managers throughout the teams to create true change.
And thanks. Process point, in order to hit these six questions and now seven because you had two, that means it's a lightning round of approximately 1 minute per answer.
Okay.
Because we got some loquacious ladies up here. Go for it. Who's up?
I'll answer the second question on accountability and leadership accountability. I don't agree philosophically with the tie into the bonus, because to me it's good leadership, because diversity is a mix, inclusion is optimizing the mix, and engagement is making sure it's as best possible as it can be. So how we drove leadership accountability in the past was giving leaders a lot of data about what was working and not working in their organizations from a talent standpoint. And then when it came time to report to the board of directors, it was not me presenting or the CEO, it was the executives presenting about their data and what was working and what wasn't. And that was the way we did it. Mm-hmm. And so they were on the hook for what was going on and not working and what they were doing about it.
Anyone want to take the first question?
Yeah, I got 10 seconds on that. Okay, trust and transparency, super, super important. If folks feel like they can trust the people running the calculations and collecting the data, you're good. That happens through transparency. If you know exactly what they're going to be doing with the data, what they're not going to be doing with the data, who they're going to be sharing it with, who they're not going to be sharing it with, i.e. the government, that really, really helps, right? So there's a big controversy about census stuff right now because they're collecting citizenship information. Question mark. Okay, moving on.
Awesome. All right, next question.
Me?
Oh, we're going to go to that side. Sorry, you're right.
I think Susan might be able to help me the most with this, but I want everybody's answer. I am the first HR person at a startup in Silicon Valley with an all-white male leadership team.
What a great
opportunity.
Help me, I'm tired.
Great.
They have the best of intentions, and when they hired me on, they said that this is, you know, we realize what you're looking at right now, and they want to help, but sometimes that doesn't always come into practice or feel like it's there. Like it's actually, like the intention is there, the actions are not.
Right.
Could each of you give me like a one-liner or one big piece that I can use to communicate the importance or communicate to them, help them look in the mirror a little bit, I suppose.
One sentence each. Go.
It is leadership's accountability to create high-performing teams that are inclusive.
Set expectations for how much you can kick their ass and then kick their ass according to those expectations.
We kick each other's asses. I feel like it's a... Yeah.
Great. All the asses.
And because you're a startup, I would say look to your referrals. We tend to have friends that are just like us, and startups and executive teams just replicate over and over themselves. But experiments have shown us, sorry, I'm into like two sentences, three here, that if you just ask folks to think about diversity in their network and say diversity is a goal for us, can you think about that when you refer, you get 50% more diversity in referrals. Mm. Just
fantastic.
To ask.
Thank
awesome.
You.
All right, you're up.
Great. I have the opposite question. I come from a small education nonprofit, so we have diversity all over the place. Where we're struggling is inclusion. So if you guys could share a little bit about how to move past just checking that nice box of diversity and into inclusion and equity.
One quick tool we've used with a great client of ours, Cliff Bar. Simple thing to put a table tent on every meeting table that gives tips for running inclusive meetings. Hmm. 5 tips, like make sure that you've heard from everyone in the room. You know, seek other people's perspectives. Send out an agenda ahead of time. So you know, simple things like that. Little tools to remind people when they're actually in the process to be inclusive.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think too many companies do the check the box on diversity and then don't know what to do with it afterwards. That's why I think fundamentally you got to start with understanding the dominant group privilege dynamic. And so at least talking to one to get them engaged to look at that.
Conversation norms are really great. And having really, really hard conversations using the norms that you've set up can be really powerful.
Thank you. All right, this side.
So I've also worked with a lot of startups, and I think something that I've seen work well is breaking the problem down into very kind of actionable, bite-sized things, like the discussion was talking about. So an example is Textio, the company that has said, okay, let's take job descriptions. And, you know, in working with startup companies, that's something I can easily give them and say, you can utilize Textio, you know, as you're thinking about your recruiting process. Have you seen other tools like that? Or I guess more broadly, what role do you see technology playing in this process?
You should answer that
okay,
one.
Sure. Junco is another one that does similar things. Junco. So there are a lot of things like that for the beginning of the pipeline, AI things, and then of course the product that I have in beta, Loom, the culture map. Look up Loom Technologies. That's part of what we're doing as well. Yes. But yeah, so Junco is the first one that I would think about at that pipeline.
I can also recommend Intello. They anonymize information, I think, during the recruiting and the hiring process. Super, super useful. Yeah. Does a lot to challenge bias.
Awesome. Cool. Over here.
Hi. I work at VMware, and this is an issue in tech in general. One of the big pluses of working in tech is that we can work remotely, right? But how can you incorporate diversity with such a remote base? Like, when people aren't talking to each other and seeing each other in person, like, how do you facilitate that those diversity conversations and making sure everyone's being included? Because it's just a voice on the phone a lot of times.
So. Yeah, at some companies, we've done this. I know my current company, Applied Materials, has done this, is do great training on virtual leadership. How do you become a good virtual leader? Mm-hmm. With employees all over the world. And so there are some really good practices out there around being a good virtual leader.
I've seen one leader in particular who's stellar at this, Damian Hooper Campbell at eBay. He's a partner of ours. He lives it. Every time we have a virtual meeting, there's always 2 or 3 people who are coming in virtually, and he always starts with them. It's just a simple thing to always, in a meeting, start with the person who's virtual. Mm-hmm. Have them check in first. One thing that we do, we're at Verche, we are all remote as well. We do like a human moment check-in every meeting. Everyone just takes 1 minute. It's like, you know, what's going on with you right now? What do you need to clear? It's sort of like, what's going on with you that we all need to know as your team to support you and be here? Or it's just like, how was your weekend? Mm-hmm. I think that humanity really helps.
It does. Awesome. Last Thank question.
You. Awesome. I think informal and organic sponsorship relationships are really important between like a middle manager and an executive. What are your thoughts in the absence of that? What are your thoughts on more formal sponsorship programs where people get matched and how do you execute them really well?
Ooh. Oh, I have so or much to you? Say about this. Well, I'll just say 2 quick things. I absolutely feel like they need to be formalized because the research shows if you do not formalize them, it is white and old boys networks that end up. Creating these informal sponsorship and mentorship. So first of all, like I think they need to be formalized in order to have equity across the company, and we need to be thoughtful about who we match. Often people go, oh, well, we should match like a woman leader to a woman IC or someone at, you know, mid-level. We actually need to be matching people across identities. As I said before, it's about connecting with majority group and, you know, making sure they're getting a mix of different people that they're connecting to, not people of their own identity group.
Shameless plug, we're going to be signing books after this, like immediately after this at 4:00, so we're going to run, and here's our MC.
I was going to give you the plug, so you didn't do the shameless plug.
Oh, I'm shameless.
Plug. Please
I'm
be just, sure that
Selena told me to get there first.
Well,
Well, again, a big round of applause to our panelists and to our thought leaders. Thank you.
Good job, Jean. So fun.
Awesome. We hope that you enjoyed this session. And yes, please visit our wonderful authors. They will be signing books, and enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you.